5 o'clock.
Welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity.com, welcoming you this Saturday and every Saturday evening for an hour of education, enlightenment, and entertainment dealing with the aftermath of crime and tragedy and everything that surrounds it. So I want to welcome all of you, whether you be a first-timer or whether you be a veteran, whether you be local or far away. It's always nice to have everyone here, and we do welcome you. Want to remind you that if you're not able to listen live, Shattered Lives has a full library of 2.5 years of archived shows to listen to at any time, anywhere. And I have to tell you, I'm very excited about having our guest this evening because she's one of my very favorite people that I admire and respect because she has such a significant and important job and helps many, many people with the populations that we serve day in and day out. And it's a very unique organization. And so in just a minute, we'll introduce her, but I want to introduce Delilah, of course. Good evening, and how's everything in Myrtle Beach?
Everything's fine here in Myrtle Beach, Donna. Sunny and beautiful, lovely fall day.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it. I can't wait to get there. And in a little while, it's kind of cold and chilly here. But this is a warm and friendly radio show, no matter what the topic. And it's always very interesting. And, you know, I haven't had the opportunity to chat at all with Cheryl McCullen since our Q Center conference, which is way back in the spring. So I think it's a real treat. What, in your perspective, I know you've known her for quite some time, what does she bring to the table as far as you're concerned?
Oh, gosh, everything. I've been aware of Cheryl and her work for a long time, and I'm always so happy that she comes. She's now, I think, part of the Q family, so you might as well put it on the calendar again this year, Cheryl.
That's right. That's right.
Everybody always raves about your instruction and the presentations that you give, and because everything is done so professionally, and yet, you know, with your personality, it just brings it all down to earth to a point where people understand what you're talking about. So we really appreciate that.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, if the Institute ever has to go away, I think she has a spot on Saturday Night Live. I really do. So without further ado, let's just welcome Cheryl McCullen, and for her close friends and people she hangs out with, she's known as Mac, I believe. So anyway, maybe after this show I can call her Mac. It's such a wonderful treat to have you. Cheryl, thank you so much for being with us. I think you're going to be a wealth of information for our audience, and thank you for sharing your time with us. We know you're on Nancy Grace a lot, but I'm very honored to have you on our show.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here, and I'm a huge fan of yours as well. And please call me Mac. Absolutely. I'm
okay.
Much more comfortable with that. And as far as the Q Center being on my calendar, I think my children would be headed up that way whether I was on the program or not. So I think we're coming. They adore it. They have learned so much and had so many great conversations with folks there that it gives them almost a better understanding of what I do for a living. So it's a nice weekend for us always.
It certainly is. And so I think it's on all of our calendars. And with that, Delilah and I being coordinators, you know, it just kind of makes sense and something to look forward to. But, you know, with that, October is such an important month for many of us in many respects, because it pays tribute to many people with domestic violence and other types of issues. And, you know, it's very rare that you find somebody that has the opportunity to do what you do, to live your passion, and to also to be able to teach others and pass on what you know. And so from the description that we have up on our post, we know that the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute in the Atlanta area is approximately 10 years old. Is that right, Cheryl?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can you give us a little thumbnail sketch about how that got started and where you've come from in 10 years to now?
Sure. Absolutely. Well, I was working with a local sheriff's department running their cold case squad, and simultaneously I was teaching college at night. So one night, you know, I asked the sheriff if I could take one of the case files that I thought was really extraordinary to my class and let them take a look at it. And I'm telling you, the moment I walked into that classroom with an actual case file, everything changed about the way that I thought I need to be teaching. They could not turn that case loose. And the sheriff was extremely pleased with some of the ideas that they had and suggestions that maybe what we need to be doing going forward. And
mm-hmm.
It was remarkable to watch them delve into something and not let go, not hesitate, not stop. I mean, honey, they wouldn't go to other classes. They didn't even want to do the regular classwork in my class. They literally wanted to work on this case, and that's all. So I thought, you know what? This is what we need to be doing. So I pulled a bunch of my friends together and all that, and you know, I'm outside at work. Sorry to hear planes. So then we, you know, decided, you know what, we need to take these cases and really break them down and, you know, compartmentalize based on all of our areas of expertise and really teach them as they go through it. Well, then that kind of morphed into this institute where I have friends at other colleges, so Lou Harris over at Faulkner and Ralph Ayamo at Auburn, Montgomery, they were like, yeah, we're in. So then we started doing bigger cases, and then we had more colleges, and then we started doing high-profile cases, and then we became a nonprofit, and now we're in about 30 colleges across the country, and we are housed at Argosy University in Dunwoody, but we have South University now that's in Virginia Beach, in Florida, in Savannah. I'm in Savannah, Georgia right now. And then, you know, you just have all this wealth of knowledge, whether it's Syracuse or Metro State College of Denver or Illinois Valley or Chatham Women's College in Pennsylvania. I mean, you're talking about levels of expertise that will just enhance a case and trying to put together an action plan for law enforcement that you just can't match it.
And this is an all volunteer effort for your colleagues as well as the students. They don't get college credit for it, correct?
Correct. There's no college credit. There's no grade. There's no internship. And nobody is paid. No one. Everybody volunteers their time, myself included. So it's really important to us that the donations that we get go to travel, training, and equipment. That's it.
Wow.
So if I need to get an expert somewhere, like, for example, you know, I need somebody to get to Vidalia, Georgia, or Oklahoma, or New Mexico, we can do that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, can you just give us an example when you said that, you know, the sheriff was very impressed with regard to the kinds of suggestions that the students came up with. Now, it's a very different perspective. How was it so different that they would have said, well, gee, we never thought of that? Can you give us some examples of how they totally look at something differently as compared to, quote-unquote, law enforcement?
Sure. First of all, one thing that I've always subscribed to is civilians solve crime all the time. And if you give them a lot of information, they can be quite helpful to you, especially if there's an area that is not exactly law enforcement. And I'll give you an example. In one double homicide that we worked, both the victims as well as the perpetrator were struggling with drug addiction. Well, if you've never struggled with drug addiction, there's some things you're going to miss, and there's some ways they think that you don't think. So if you have a student, researcher, that is a recovering addict, they're going to have suggestions for you about how to interview and how to ask a question and to kind of break down the BS that they're going to automatically feed you. That we're not trained like that. We're trained to recognize, hey, this guy might be a drug addict. We're not trained, how do I question him?
Right.
Well, they can tell you. And it's just awesome to watch them. And here's the other reality. Everybody has lived this unique path. Well, that path gives you some type of expertise, whether it, you can play the piano or you know how to make crack in the sink, right? Both of those things are a gift. And so if I'm working undercover and I need somebody that can go in and pretend to be the, you know, organist at a church, I'm going to pick the person that can play. If I need somebody to go in, work vice and act like they're strung out on heroin, hey, you watched, unfortunately, your mom maybe. But you have that gift, and I truly believe that's what it is. And everybody has one. Everybody has a gift. And some people know when somebody's an abuser because they've been abused. Somebody knows a pedophile because they've been hurt. Somebody knows, you know, different types of addiction. Some people know different types of mental illness. And those are unfortunate paths. But at the same time, it's a gift.
How are you student volunteers selected? I mean, with your reputation now, everyone must be clamoring to get in and to. It's almost like here in Connecticut at our Henry Lee Institute, the same thing. The waiting list is like, you know, a mile long. How do you go about you know, finding your students and the expertise?
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm no Henry Lee. I adore him.
Yes, you are.
And I've actually been trained by him, and he is so phenomenal. One of the best weeks of my entire career, I will tell you that straight out. The Institute for me is more like a church. If you want to come, come on. So I don't require a GPA. I don't require a specific major. I don't require an attendance record, anything like that. If you come to me and say, hey, I'm a D student, I don't have show up for class, I'd rather be surfing, but I want to help you on this case, then God love you, come on. Because
all right.
well, first of all, you're my kind of student. I can understand you more than I can the valedictorian. And if you have a certain insight or just the willingness that you want to help somebody, there's no way I'm going to say,
yeah.
There's no way I'm going to say no to help. I'm just not. So if you've got somebody missing or you've got somebody hurt, I'll take all the help in the world. And the other reality, again, is you may have somebody that maybe is not a great student, but their common sense, you can't train that and you can't teach that. And again, they may look at a case and go, he wouldn't have gone this route. He would have gone this way. And they can explain to you exactly why that would have happened, and they're on to something.
Right.
Is that with Wanda Levy, actually?
Okay.
Well,
yes,
Cheryl, how do you choose which cases that your students are going to work on, and then how long do you work that case? And I guess what are the expected outcomes of once you take a case on? What do you expect the outcome to be?
When we first started, we would always tell families, we will devote a year, because it may take us 3 months, you know, 3 months to really learn the case.
Yeah.
6 months to really kind of work it our way, and then another 3 months or so to really figure out a proper action plan for law enforcement. And that's, you know, bringing in experts and training as we go through it. So we devote a year no matter what. Every case, we don't need a year. Chandra Levy took us 4 months. We didn't need a year. But then you have a case like Natalie Holloway or Josh Powell that we're not going to stop working even though a year has passed because mm-hmm. we think there's more happening. And we want to keep, you know, the help out there. We want to keep the word going. So we don't necessarily turn it loose just because the calendar says a year is up. That's just
right.
what we originally say we'll do. But we've kept some like Morris Ford. I think we've worked that case 5 years now. So
you've got a lot going on simultaneously then?
Yes. And again, it's reality. I don't have one case at the police department.
Right.
You know, so
it's not like Law and Order. They make you think like you devote 24 hours to them.
It is absolutely not like Law and Order. And, you know, we all have families and we all have other jobs and we all have other cases. And so for the students, what I usually try to teach them is if there's a lull in a case, you're waiting for a lab report to come back, you're waiting for a witness to call you back, there's another case you can be doing something on. And so it's nice that there's really no downtime.
Yeah.
You know?
And do they typically do this, like, on off hours, on weekends? I mean, what kind
yeah.
of is it any kind of schedule that they want to maintain? Is your... And I know you're in a new facility now, which we should talk about, too, because it looks fantastic.
Oh,
how
does that unbelievable. Okay.
Open up your potential, Cheryl, in terms of, you know, what you can do now?
It does. I mean, you have just nailed it because we were in a great place that was very, very good to us for a long time. And then Argosy came to us and said, look, you know, we want to open this up to you, use it however you want, whenever you want. And Argosy University gave us a designated room for the files, which is locked, and there's only two or three people that even have a key.
Mm-hmm.
And then they gave us a FATS simulator for training, and they gave us classrooms and meeting rooms and all of this technology that, frankly, I don't even know how to work at all yet. And we were able to do a video conference with 17 colleges across nine states and over 200 students recently.
Wow.
And, I mean, that was beyond anything that I
even
realized
you
could do. It was remarkable. And what we were able to get from that family, which I can't really talk about yet, but what we were able to get from that family, I'm telling you, has changed the entire dynamic of our action plans. No question about it. Because, again, you had 200 people in the same place, at the same time, for the same reason, to try to solve something. And you're going to move a lot, and you're going to move quickly, and you're going to get right to the root of it, because with everybody asking all these unbelievably fascinating and relevant questions, you know, you just get on this path to solvability quickly.
Mm-hmm. 200 opinions, everyone's writing down it. Well, everyone's putting down all the data, and then you have to sort out the commonalities or the patterns or something
right.
new. Is that how you do
right.
it?
Right. That's how we do it. And it's
yeah.
quick. And we met for a solid 2 hours of talking. We looked over evidence. We interviewed two witnesses, and I mean in-depth interviews. And you're talking about 400 man hours. What department could do that?
They
nobody.
Couldn't.
They couldn't do it. And they especially could not do it for free. Well, see, that's what Argosy affords us. We don't have to worry about rent. We don't have to worry about keeping the light. It's just this incredible outpouring of support. And all the colleges do it. South does it. Auburn University, Montgomery does it. Faulkner does it. Illinois Valley, Metro State College of Denver, Syracuse, Kennesaw, Georgia State, they all do it. They're all donating, you know, space and expertise and equipment. And the families, y'all, they come away with just this renewed sense that, yes, people care. Because at any given day, 500 people are working on this. 500 across, you know, 30 colleges.
Wow, that just sounds amazing. Is that going to be? Was this something unusual for a specific selected case, or would this kind of modus operandi be part of of your protocol, Mac, when you do any case. I mean, sure, you're going to handpick which case would be most appropriate, but do you see yourself doing this a lot more?
Now that we know how to work the equipment, absolutely. because what Dwayne Thompson was able to do, and he's somebody you really need to interview at some point because he is extraordinary. And he wants no accolade, he wants no attention, but he's not only academically sound because he's got the PhD, but he's worked undercover dope, he's a SWAT sniper. I mean, he's just this all-around cop's cop, but he brings such a level of expertise that when he gets to a room, I was going to do something at Argosy. And he said, that's great. He said, let's do something at Argosy, but why don't we invite everybody else? And I did not know how to do that. He's like, I got it. I'll take care of everything. And it's something that we have to do over and over and over because it means so much to all the students to have access to these witnesses and, you know, victims and, you know, the other experts. Because we had 15 experts, nationally recognized people, you know, like Holly Hughes and Gurdin. You know, I mean, it's just people that they can't, they're untouchable without the Institute. But let me answer one part of your question that I didn't really answer fully because I got on a little bit of a tangent. But the way we pick cases is I try to find cases that have different areas of discipline so that individual colleges really have something that they can represent and do for us. So I want a case that has crime mapping for Denver. I want a case that has victimology for Alabama. I want a case that has, you know, arson for Oklahoma. So all this different, you know, instruction can be, you know, done at the same time. So if they go to a traditional 4 years, in that 4 years, they'll get 12 different disciplines at an expert level. So by the time they graduate, they're ready. True.
Wow. It's just so impressive. I'm coming down to visit your church.
Please, come anytime.
Ryan and I are coming. We already talked about it.
Yeah, you should do a remote show from there, and we'll get a panel of our experts, and we'll go through a case, and we'll open it up to everybody in your chat room and say, let's get her done.
Oh, my God. We did a two-hour special at the Henry Lee Institute, and we did a whole big tour. That was wonderful. A lot of work, but it was wonderful. And, yes, let's talk about that later. But and now you got me all excited. But in any case, tell us, are you a one of a kind institute across the country?
I didn't really hear your question. I'm so sorry.
Are you a one of a kind institute across the country?
Yes. Yes.
So you are okay. Nobody else does what you do quite like you do it. Is that right?
Not at all. The Henry Lee Institute uses graduate students, and they have a very specific discipline, which is forensic science. Our institute has all the disciplines, and they will use any major. We have business students. We've even had fashion design students, nursing students. Because, again, everybody has a gift, and I'll give an example. We had one case where a woman was thrown into a lake. Only partially, so only her upper torso made it into the water. And it appeared to us that she was thrown from a car and went down the embankment but didn't quite make it all the way to the water. So part of her decomposed very quickly, and her clothing, her skirt, was perfect. But it was a material that was so unusual to me, it almost looked like burlap, but it was extremely soft. So I took the clothing to one of our fashion directors, and she was able to explain to me exactly what this clothing was, exactly what the material was, why there were no tags in it. Mm-hmm. And my theory early on is this woman was never reported missing, and I thought she might be a nanny from another country, and her family may not even know what city or state she wound up in. And she told me that it was absolutely handmade, and that the material came from the United Kingdom. She could tell me that straight up.
Wow.
So let me know you're on the right track.
Yeah. Wow, that's just Yeah, absolutely amazing that you could bring in all of those different sources when you need to. And you know, I would like to get into some specific cases, but I don't want to leave to the end because I know that, like the Q Center, you depend upon donations and whatnot. Can you, right at this juncture, so that we definitely have it, and will you please tell us contact information where people might be able to send donations if they're interested?
Sure. If they're interested, they can send them to the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at 235 10th Street in Atlanta.
Okay.
And that's 30318. And you can send us a message on Facebook. We have 3 Facebook pages. We're on Instagram. Any way you want to reach us is fabulous. And you can send a quick message saying, hey, I would like for my money to specifically go to this or that, and we'll make sure that happens.
Wonderful. Yeah, well, sometimes we save it to the end and we get talking and we forget, so we wanted to get that in. That's great. When you're working a case and you're working with victims, what's your best defense against mistakes and injustices from happening? Like, how can they, you know, when you're working with this family now, how can they prepare for what's going to happen, you know, in the future? Or if they've had experiences where they're from a small town and the law enforcement maybe isn't as experienced, you know, maybe they're not used to dealing with the fact that they're not going to get as many answers from them, but you're giving them a new opportunity.
Pretty much exactly like that. We sit down with them, and we are extremely honest that we do not Monday morning quarterback. We're not going to talk bad about law enforcement. Chances are law enforcement didn't make any mistakes. Sometimes cases just go cold, and sometimes it's not even a matter of a case being cold. Like, for example, Natalie Holloway, that wasn't a whodunit. Everybody in the world knew who did it. That case wasn't unsolved. That case was unproven. And there's a big difference. And there's a lot of, you know, police officers across this country that would love to put somebody in prison that they know is responsible, but they don't have the legal probable cause to do that. So, again, we sit down and we're real honest. And the only thing we ever promise anybody is that we have hundreds of people that are going to care about what happened to your loved one. Past that, we don't promise anything. Nothing. Because there may not be anything we can do. Now, so far, there hasn't been a case where we couldn't do something, and sometimes it was really unique. But like with Amber Hagerman, the little girl that started the Amber Alert system out of Texas, honey, they did everything. They thought of every possible investigative avenue to go down. And we could not think of anything that they did not do. No rock was left unturned. But we decided one thing we could do was start the conversation over, because maybe there's somebody that knows something that's been waiting on the police to come talk to them. That happened. And if we start the conversation again, then maybe something will come of it. Well, a young man by the name of Jake Tinsley was 14 years old and reached out to us and said, I write a comic book, and I would like to help you with Amber's case. Well, we thought that was so extraordinary, and I'm not a comic book person. I don't know that much about them, but I was pretty sure that an actual live victim had never been on the cover of one. And so we did a little bit of research, and sure enough, no actual victim had ever been on the cover of a comic book. So we did that. And the comic book community was awesome to us and got the comic book out everywhere. And then that made Good Morning America. And that one episode of Good Morning America had over 4 million hits. So you figure 4 million people watched it and then put it on Facebook, and then another 8 million saw that, then we have absolutely started the conversation again. So we felt we at least did something. But, you know, Donna Norris, her mom, is just an extraordinary person that was so grateful that, you know, we were just trying. But mm-hmm. are we going to be able to solve her case? No. And for the students, that's another thing to learn. You don't solve them all, Donna. You don't.
Mm-hmm. No. But you can start the conversation again. You can get the media interested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody grows a conscience at some point, you know, if the time
yeah.
is right
sure.
and the situation, you know, that's what you're saying. You do all that you can do. What in particular, is there a particular case or cases that you would like to maybe discuss in general terms that can kind of give us some more illustrative purposes of what you've been speaking about?
Sure. We recently turned some evidence over to the FBI, and that was a case that occurred July 25th, 1946. So that's the coldest case we've ever worked. And we were reasonably sure where the murders occurred. And
mm-hmm.
so we thought, well, let's go look for evidence, because one night in the war room, it was about midnight, and I don't even know why I said it, but I was real tired, and I said, well, you know what? Bullets don't disintegrate. Well, then it hit me. Bullets
mm-hmm.
don't disintegrate. So if you've got four people that were shot over 100 times apiece, there's
mm-hmm.
bullets, fragments, or casings in the ground.
Right.
So let's go look for them. So then I called Terry Powis over at Kennesaw State College, who does archaeology, and I said, look, I said, you don't know me, but I've read some of your stuff, and I know you found bullets that are 200 years old. Do you think you can find one that's 64 years old? And he's like, I'm intrigued. I'm in. So he brought all his students, and Georgia State University brought their students with the ground-penetrating computer. And then I brought the crime scene people and the ballistics experts and DNR, and Holly and all them from at that time, she was still with the prosecutor's office in Fulton. We go out there, and within 45 minutes, we have our first bullet. Within 3 hours, we have 27 bullets, fragments, or casings. Over
mm-hmm.
a period of 3 days, we had over 80 bullets, fragments, or casings. And
wow.
there was Chris
yeah.
Robinson out there, who was the head of the crime lab for the Atlanta Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
He's a forensics guy, and he's a ballistics guy. And so he's identifying the shells and the bullets right there on the spot. And so the students are getting all this information immediately. And he's showing them the striations and how we recovered more than one 38 slug. And he was able to show how they were different 38. Well, in 1946, that was a standard police weapon. So it's one of the coolest things I've ever been a part of. And like I said, the FBI, you know, came and got it, and we are prayerful that they'll be able to cross-check that maybe against a weapon. Who knows?
That, yeah, it's just awe-inspiring, isn't it, Delilah? When you,
yeah, correct me if
like
I'm
that.
Wrong, Cheryl, but didn't you talk about the Mary Shotwell Little case when you were at the Q conference? Isn't there some update on that
sure.
recently?
Yeah, there is
so.
Actually a little bit of update on that. We've requested that the family give DNA, and then the other update on that, which is extraordinarily puzzling and fascinating at the same time, is one of the major witnesses that was friends with Mary Shotwell Little and then another lady by the name of Diane Shields has recently gotten a phone call from the main suspect in the case. So that's one of the things, again, we immediately turned over to law enforcement, because the only people that she's really been involved with is us. So her first phone call was to us. And so we need to redirect her to the police department quickly, because if he's reaching out at this point after 50 years,
wow.
then we think, you know, you're not going to rule out a deathbed confession.
Yeah, those happen occasionally, don't they, to clear their conscience?
There's always hope. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So what else have you been working on?
Cases, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh,
goodness. If you want to share that.
No, of course.
What?
Of course.
Sure.
One main case that we've been working extremely actively is Vi Ripken. And Vi Ripken, the mother, of a famous baseball player, Cal Ripken, who played for the Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah.
And Vi was kidnapped from her home about 7:30 in the morning, July 24th, and driven around in her own Lincoln Town car for 24 hours. And he covered her eyes and he bound her hands behind her back. He never ransomed her. He never hurt her. He never assaulted her, never demanded money, her car, nothing. He mm-hmm. lit cigarettes for her. He stopped and got her something to eat. Then he drove her back to her neighborhood, not to her home, but the neighborhood, and got out and left. That's it.
Wow.
How bizarre.
It's very bizarre.
When did this happen? What year? Was this
2012. So, Aberdeen, Maryland, there's a detective mm-hmm. there, John Geisel, who is extraordinary. He's fantastic. And I wish I could tell y'all all the reasons he's fantastic, but it would take the rest of my hour. But mm-hmm. he is devoted, and he is smart, and he is driven, and he welcomes our help. So, again, in talking to him, he's done everything. He's got the video from the Walmart. He's putting it everywhere. Y'all can please go to my Facebook pages and see the composite and the video of the suspect. Feel free to, you know, add that to your page because this guy is somewhere. And Cal Ripken has offered $100,000 to anybody that knows who this guy is. He's been mm-hmm. on America's Most Wanted twice, and they just can't find him. And so, you know, in talking with the detective, we were stumped. We don't know how to help you. I mean, obviously, with, you know, 27, 30 colleges and all these college students, social media is not a problem. We can put something literally everywhere within minutes. But we wanted to do more than that. We wanted to do something significant. So we have a plan that we have developed that is a unique fugitive apprehension program that if you'll have me back in January, I can tell you all about it.
Okay.
But I can't tell you right now. But we're really excited, and the program is so unique and so unusual that Crime Stoppers and the United States Army and the United States Secret Service and the Marshal Service and all local police departments that we have talked to so far, everybody's yeah. in.
Fugitive Apprehension Program?
Correct. So mm-hmm. we think we're on to something really unique that nobody's ever done before, and we think
yeah.
it'll work. But again, I can't tell you what it is.
Okay.
Because if I start telling you now, it ain't going to work. But, but again, in January, I'll be happy to
talk
about it. Can you give us a little bit? I can't. Because we give it away.
I understand. Wow. Well, that's what, and so this is the test case for this, the Ripken, are there other
Ripken.
Cases you might be able to apply it to?
There will be other cases we apply it to, yes.
Wow. And how did this new thing come about? Was it a collective thought process between you and students? Or, I mean, you don't have to tell me details. I'm just curious, like, did this occur to you in a dream one day?
No, the idea popped in my head. And then
uh-huh.
I immediately went to 10 experts that I trust more than anything. And they were all like,
mm-hmm.
yes, 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 that'll work. And then I approached the fugitive apprehension people, again, with the Marshal Service and the Secret Service and the FBI, and they were like, yeah, we think that'll work. So
yeah.
we're going to try. And you know, that's,
wow.
we're in the business of trying. And there's no
sure.
failure when you care and you do something. So
yeah. Well, how many, just so that we're informed, because I don't know the numbers in our audiences, what are the how common is it that there's fugitives out there on the loose? Is it in the thousands?
Yes. If you figure every single of, you know, like unsolved case, that
mm-hmm.
equates to a killer walking free, walking around. He's at the grocery store with you, at the movies with you, at restaurants with you. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, 60,000 homicides go unsolved every year. Well, then you
mm-hmm.
add to that the next year, and then you add to that the next year. If they remain unsolved, that number just builds and builds and builds.
Right. And how many, I mean, your benchmark is you work on them for a year, And, you know, like you said, this is in, 1949, one of them. How many times do you go back to the well, or you put it aside and you work on it intensely for a year? And then what happens? Do you, like, file it? And then if something comes up, then you might reopen it just like regular cold case units?
Well, we don't ever close them, but we might be more active on something else for a little while.
Yeah.
But what happens with us that is really unique is with some of the colleges, they get new students every term. Well, then that means there's somebody that's never heard of Mary Shotwell Little that wants to go through the box. So we can put fresh eyes on a case continuously, which is what we do. So it's
okay.
It's not like any of them sit dormant at all.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And do you meet with all of your colleagues in these various colleges for, you know, like monthly meetings? Or is it just one of these things, I need you for this, and then you kind of put something together on the spot?
Right.
I mean,
A little bit of both. If it was a monthly meeting, I would add the University of Hawaii immediately. So it's not a monthly meeting, but, you know, we've got experts that run criminal justice departments that are former chiefs of police. So they don't need me to come meet with them. They're a chief. They're good. And they know what they're doing. And we have people that have been in CSI for 30 years. They don't need me to come look over their shoulder. They call me if they need something. So the way we leave it is, here's the case. You know what your area is. You work it. So, see, each college works independently.
Okay.
We don't talk to each other. So when everybody's finished, they send it all to the clearinghouse. And then at that point, everybody says, wait a minute. The eight schools that have already sent something back, they're pinpointing the same perpetrator. So then we know we're on the right track because we haven't shared notes or theories or anything.
Oh, and then you all sit down together, I mean, whether it's online or whatnot.
Correct.
You sort it all out.
Correct. So what happens is, like with Natalie Holloway, we had probably 75 national experts look at that. Everybody agreed he was going to reoffend. Everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody that said, oh, he's only going to do this once, and that's it, and it was an accident anyway. Not one person believes that. So then you go back to the students and you say, look, we have a decision to make because the Institute never publishes our findings. That's not what we do. Law enforcement gets the findings, period. And then they do what they need to do with it. If they feel like there's any validity to it, they act on it. If not, well, we tried, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Aruba would not communicate with us at all. They refused. Multiple letters, multiple phone calls, nothing in return. So we made the decision that we were going to go public with the fact that we thought he would reoffend and that we thought that he would specifically reoffend within 5 years. Well, unfortunately, when we're right, it's good news. And, you know, of course, he murdered Stephanie Flores. So there you go.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, when you worked the Chandra Levy case, wasn't a lot of your work instrumental in solving that case?
Well, her mom has certainly been very gracious saying that. But, you know, I'll tell you again, law enforcement has got a job that is so difficult in these type of situations because once they get on a track, it's hard to get off of that track. And so for us coming in, again, we listened to our experts, if you will. So if you have a couple of people in the room that have been unfaithful, then they can tell you why that happened and maybe what they thought about the person they were actually being unfaithful with. And so you start to paint this picture that, you know, we don't really think the congressman cared that much about her. She wasn't that significant to him. So if she wasn't significant, then why in the world would he have a motive to kill her? Well, we couldn't think of a motive. So then we drop back and we say, okay, let's stop talking about him for 2 weeks. You know what I mean? Just give ourselves a little break and see if we can find anybody else that is offended in 20 miles. Well, we found somebody that offended within 10 feet. And that would be Igmar Gladicki. So we thought, let's stay on him a minute. And that's when we brought in profilers and we brought in detectives and we brought in all these, you know, different experts and stalking and everything else. And we brought down the gentleman that wrote Murder in, you know, Horse Creek. And everybody said, wait a minute, what you're saying is making sense to us. So then we found a second case, again, within about 20 feet. And it's this guy again. And we're like, seriously, how did they miss this guy? And all three were small, petite women with brown, curly hair running. And they would come to the end of their workout, which was an uphill, which means they're fatigued. They're not going to be able to really fight you off because they're wore out. And they all had a Walkman, so they're not going to hear you coming up behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So the profiler, Dr. Hatfield Fassatelli, told us, she said, look, go in his jail cell. He's going to have something of her. So that's one of the things we said, that in his prison cell, he would have something of Chandra. Well, he did. He had an 8x10 picture of her.
Mm.
So,
wow.
You know.
So, you know, they can't think of everything, but like you say, there's so much value in a bunch of new sets of eyes and ears and perspectives, and that's where the power is, because, you know, one set of the original set of eyes gets tired, and you know, divergent thinking skills are very, very useful once you,
right.
You know, you get off and you think, and I think that's what your institute is about. It's you think out of the box all the time, and that's
yes,
why you're successful,
right?
You
well,
know,
I tell the students all the time, I said, let's just, you know, if Jimi Hendrix were a detective, right? So Jimi Hendrix is known as one of the greatest guitar players ever, but he played it upside down and backwards.
Yeah.
But it worked because he couldn't play it traditionally because he was left-handed and a little dyslexic, right? So he just flipped it over and taught himself to play the only way he knew how to play. So to me, you know, I push the students. Just because law enforcement hasn't thought of it doesn't mean it's not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
They just hadn't thought of it, and that's okay. You know?
Yeah.
It's okay. So.
Well, great minds, and, you know, it takes a village, as they say. You're a good village. What is it, can you describe, is there like a day in the life or for you, or is every single day different? And is that what
every
you like?
Single day is different, and that's one
it
thing
is.
That I love about it. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's all unpredictable. You never know
mm-hmm.
what a student or an expert's going to come up with or want to try, and law enforcement has been so fantastic that, for the most part, they're like, look, whatever you come up with, call me. You know, we either want to try
mm-hmm.
it or maybe we won't, but we want to hear it. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, that is so, it's overwhelming, I think, sometimes for the students that you've got people like Alex Fanning or, you know, Dr. Hatfield or Claire Farley. They're going to listen to their theory and really take it, you know, as something that's credible. So for
sure.
them, they get in a room with these people that they've only seen on TV, and they've Googled, and they think, oh, man, I can't even talk to this person. Well, you end up talking to this person, and you have somebody like Vince Velasquez tell you, hey, that's got legs. Let's explore this a minute. Well, what
mm-hmm.
that does for you as a student, you think, wait a minute, if Vince Velasquez thinks I'm smart, then I'm smart. And that's all
right.
there to it. And, I
yeah.
mean, it's incredible to watch. And,
it's so powerful.
You know, people ask me all the time, you know, how do you not get sad or down or depressed? And I'm like, about what? Because the reality is, yes, one bad person did something wrong to a good, decent person. But I know of 5,000 people that'll show
mm-hmm.
up to do something about it.
Yeah, so that's very positive.
Right?
And, yeah. And
yeah.
I totally know what you're saying. You know, having gone through everything I've gone through in my life, 57 surgeries and the homicide and all these other things, but you
Amen.
Have to always look for the good. You have to always look for good. So,
yeah.
And I think that's what all of us, you know, all of us are doing. And, you know, for sure you have challenges and limitations in what you're doing, but if you're doing something positive like this, it, it just makes the world a little better, and you keep it in perspective, and you know what you can do and what you can't do. And,
absolutely.
You know, that it just makes life worth living, I think, in trying to help other people, you know. What do you see as right now? I know you're on the horizon for new transitions and great facilities. What continues to be your biggest challenges right now, and, you know, just overall in dealing with the Institute, and what do you wish could be fixed so that you could do what you need to do better?
Money. I mean, if we had a little pool of money that we could just kind of work off interest, you know, and not have to even worry about fundraising and asking, if we could just get up and go to work and gain and train more volunteers and add, that would be the number one thing that comes to my mind. But I had a fundraiser last night, so that may be why it's in my mind. And then the second thing is, you know, having the freedom to do more of the logistics. I'd love to go to every one of the colleges every single year, but it doesn't work out that I can. I mean, I get to Oklahoma, you know, once every 3 years. I get to, you know, go to Philadelphia once every other year. So it would be nice to be able to go more and to see the students in person.
Mm-hmm.
So that part would be phenomenal for me. But every day is, like I said, different, but every day is a gift. And, you know, you get people, I get calls all the time, what can I do to help you? And sometimes it's from the most extraordinary, you never would have looked for this person to be helpful. And all of a sudden you're like, yeah, okay, well, let me think of something that you might could do for us. And, you know, you're talking about when I call somebody like Beth Holloway or I call somebody like Susan Levy, and I'm like, you know what, your daughter's picture is still up in the war room. And we think about her all the time. We have stories about them. We have experiences with y'all. And, you know, that's something that they take great comfort in, that nobody's going to forget her. And for the students, these are life-changing experiences, I'm telling you. You know, these students that go out and, you know, win a big trophy in football or baseball, that's great. But what our students get, I think it's more important. I'm telling you,
these are
real people with real pain, and they have no justice. And if our students have just a little bit involved with seeing justice served and seeing these parents get some answers, it's one of the most unique and fulfilling things I've ever been a part of.
Oh, for sure.
Well, beyond that, Cheryl, let the listeners know what are the advantages for the students who come to you. Like you say, all volunteer. There's no credit, no pay, no nothing. What are they coming away with at the end of the day?
Okay. They get national training from national experts in every single conceivable discipline in the criminal justice system. They will get hours of instruction from Alex Manning on constitutional law. They will get hours of instruction on psychopathology and profiling from Dr. Fascitelli. They will get hours of how to deal with the media from Gerdine Dyer with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. They will get hours of how to work a death investigation from Detective Vince Velasquez. They will get interviews and interrogation from Dr. Lou Harris, former FBI profiler. They will get crime scene analysis from Dr. Ralph Ayamo. I mean, it just goes on and on and on that the resume, I mean, it looks better than most people I know that have good jobs. And then on top of that, when they get into an interview and they say, well, everybody up for this job has a four-year degree. What do you got beyond that? They've worked Natalie Holloway, Shonda Levy, Tupac Shakur, the Boston Strangler. You know what I mean? And
so
who can compete for that?
Yeah.
Who can compete?
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So have they, the majority of them, gone on after their bachelor's training to just, you know, even though this is volunteer, their experience is so stellar that you can't argue with that, and they get a job in 5 minutes. I mean, it would
You can't argue with it. We've had students leave the Institute and go on and become federal agents, state agents, local police. and some have gone on to law school, and then they return as experts. So now we're in this, after 10 years, we now have students that have, you know, 6 years under their belt as an expert. It's awesome.
That it is. It's a dream come true. As a crime victim, I'm listening to you, and I'm just, you know, it's like, you know, I never envisioned that this could be possible. I wish I was about 30 years younger. I'd be in there with you.
But let me tell you, you're doing it. Getting the word out, talking to me tonight so that we can tell people, you're doing it. Your gift is so clear, it's not even funny. And so if I get 5 messages tonight on Facebook saying, hey, what can I do to help? I'm in Nebraska. What can I do to help? I'm in Vermont.
Yeah.
I've got something new. I mean, we've enacted legislation places. We've got more legislation we want to write. So that's something I never even set out to do. But we saw a need. We wrote a couple of laws. They got passed. And now that's part of what we do, too, because there's more advocacy that needs to be on the books, no question.
Right. Well, it's true. It just seems like it's expanding and expanding. And unfortunately, there's only 24 hours in the day. That's the problem, right? But, you know, I'm very inspired. I think I may write a follow-up blog with this. I haven't done in a while. But, you know, I think it's so very important, and I don't know if it may help you to put up on your Facebook to have that and the show. If that will somehow help promote what you do and maybe get more donations in or just the awareness, you know, I'll be glad to help with that. You know, like I said, it's been hugely inspiring. We have about 3 minutes left of our show. Is there any particularly some national message that you would like to convey that maybe, you know, our audience, which is quite diverse, needs to hear, some that you want to debunk or just a message that will carry them forward about your institute and so that they don't lose hope?
Yes. Cold cases right now are being solved left and right. And DNA is a big part of it. That's one of the most awesome tools we have right now. And what I love about DNA, it'll put somebody in prison and it'll help get somebody out. So I love it because it's all just justice driven. So the science behind any of it, I'm very excited about. But the other thing that I want to tell everybody is you don't have to join my institute. You can go to your local department and say, hey, I'm a retired teacher, I'm a retired police officer, I'm a retired firefighter, or whatever. Is there anything I can do to help? They need your help. So whether it's my institute or a small department or a large department, you know, if you want to get involved, I say get involved. And, you know, people say sometimes, well, you know, aren't you, you know, competing against whoever? There's zero competition, zero competition. There are enough victims going around, and if there is anybody that can solve an unsolved case out there, more power to you. I adore Dr. Henry Lee. I adore Dr. Wright. I mean, all of them. Do your thing, man, because to me, if you get 4 killers off the street, then I'm safe for the movie. You know what I mean? So it's
That's
all good.
It. That's
so,
right.
You know, I just say, you know, do whatever you can, because we meet formally the last Thursday of every month. That's when we meet formally. So I always tell people, what are you doing on your last Thursday? Because there's something you can do. Go to a soup kitchen for 20 minutes. Call somebody that's a shut-in. You know, your neighbor that's, you know, broke his leg, go cut his grass. I mean, you can do something that literally could change somebody's world.
Right.
Yeah.
It is. It's so important to pay it forward. And, you know, I think you've touched so many people's lives in so many important ways. And just to keep having contact with the victims, you say Beth Holloway and Mrs. Levy and all of those things. But this 5-minute call does mean so much. Phil Russo today, I just put something up on my Facebook about him because he's, you know, having an incredible time with his wife Sheila was massacred in Alturas by Indian and tribal native people and having a tremendous amount of, you know, barriers with his case. So, you know, just anything little that you can do. Cheryl is so right about that.
So what we're going to do is we're going to keep in touch, because I think we've got at least another show, maybe in-person visits in the future. And I will, Cheryl, this is my promise, I will try to help and promote your institute in whatever way I can. So if you need something from me, I'm here, okay?
I appreciate you both so much. And, you know, Delilah, all that you have done for years, and, you know,
yeah.
Lady Justice, I'm, like I said, I'm a huge fan. So we'll be talking to y'all again real soon. I'll give you a
you bet.
Very good. Well, with that then, we're going to close out the show, and I say thank you, everyone. Please be sure to go to DonnaGore.com, visit Shattered Lives, listen to this show and all of the other ones, and we will see you next Saturday evening for another edition. Be safe and take care.